Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. With our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look at the in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known purely for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Though these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much like how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, and maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I'm similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded, yet years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Ember for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the order and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
All right, Martin, thank you so very much. Am I coming across clear?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Tonight I want to share with you how the origin of the federal citizenship started. Before the federal government was created, there were no federal citizens. It was just the Union State citizens. In fact, who was it? General Lee. General Lee was first invited to prosecute the war against the South. He was a Virginian. And he said to Lincoln, until Virginia decides whether it's going to stay with the North or secede with the South, I can't make that decision because I will fight for my Virginia. Each of the several states are Union states or are their own sovereign countries. Anyways, we'll get to that sometime later. So let's talk about this. In 1865, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery and, quote, involuntary, end quote, servitude, except as punishment for a crime. The Supreme Court ruled that the 13th Amendment operated to free former slaves and to prohibit slavery, but it in no way conferred citizenship to the former slaves or to those of races other than the white race, because the founders of the Constitution were all of the white race. If you read many of the original founding documents of each of the Union states, every one of them talks about so-and-so, this and this and that for the white race, white man, whatever, the free white man. This is a fact. Don't sit there and get angry with me about, you know,
you're racist.
No, I'm not. I'm telling you what was going on, and you can prove this out yourself. Lincoln told us in the fourth debate with Stephen Douglas, this was in Charleston, Illinois, the year was September 1858, Lincoln said he did not want to free the slaves unless they were to be deported. He said, and I quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, that I am not, nor have ever been, in favor of making voters or jurors of the Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and the black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be this position of superior and inferior, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. I say upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, that the Negro should be denied anything," end quote. The federal government did not have the authority to determine if a former slave could become a citizen of one of the several states because the 9th and 10th Amendments said that the powers not granted specifically to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved to the states or to the people. I will mention that both the New York State and Pennsylvania State actually offered citizenship to the former black slaves that were now recently freed. It was offered to them. In other states, blacks were not citizens and therefore did not have standing in any court. And the answer to this problem was the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment used the term, quote, citizen of the United States, end quote. That's what the term that was used in the 14th Amendment. The courts have ruled that this means federal citizenship, which is similar to a citizenship of the District of Columbia. Since the federal courts did not step in until Pennsylvania or New York that it couldn't make state citizens out of the former black slaves. An argument could be made that the 14th Amendment was written primarily to afford voluntary citizenship to those of the black race that were recently freed by the 13th Amendment. If you want to delve into this, you have a number of what is referred to as the slaughterhouse cases. It did not include Indians, nor those not born in or subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. McKay versus Campbell, 2nd Sawyer, 129. Thus, the amendment recognized that, quote, an individual can be a citizen of one of the several states without being a citizen of the United States, end quote. U.S. versus Anthony, 24 Fed. Or also you have the slaughterhouse case of Cruikshank that says, quote, a citizen of the United States without being a citizen of the state. Said the same thing, only in reverse. So to restate, in the slaughterhouse cases, the court said, quote, it is quite clear then that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of a state, which are distinct from each other and which depend upon different characteristics or circumstances of the individual. Of the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United States and of the privileges and immunities of the citizen of the state and what they respectfully are, we will presently consider, but we wish to state here that it is only the former which are placed by this clause under the protection of the federal Constitution, and the latter, whatever they may be, are not intended to have any additional protections by this paragraph of the amendment. That's cute. The court has also ruled that the term United States is a metaphor, a figure of speech. In Cunard, SS Company versus Mellon, 262 U.S. 100, it said, quote, the term United States may be used in one of several senses. It may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of a sovereign in a family of nations. It may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends, or it may be the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. This is quoting Hooven and Allison versus Everett. So did the courts really say that someone could be a citizen of a state without being a citizen of the United States? And the answer is patently yes. It is true that they cited the cases, that some of them are very old, well over 100 years old. None of these cases have ever been overturned by a more recent decision. So they're every bit as valid today as a recent decision. A more recent case is Cross versus Board of Directors. This is 1966. In it, it says, quote, both before and after the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution, it's never been necessary for a person to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a citizen of his state. This is quoting, actually, Cruikshank. The courts presume you to be a federal citizen without even telling you that there are different classes of citizens. And it's up to you to dispute this. U.S. versus Slater says to us, quote, unless the defendant can prove he is not a citizen of the United States, the IRS has the right to inquire and determine a tax liability. This is 1982. So how does one prove they're not a United States citizen? By way of an irrebuttable affidavit. We'll start with that. You'll learn more on the Monday night. Oh, that's tonight's call. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. So this is all very interesting. How could the presumption of a class of citizenship even be possible? It may be only that the guilty until proven innocent is the situation if you're a federal citizen, as opposed to innocent until proven guilty. In 1866, Congress passed the first Civil Rights Act, which only applied to the District of Columbia and other federal territories. In 1868, the 14th Amendment was proclaimed to have been passed. I said proclaimed. There's even argument there. At this point, the number of subjects that the federal government had exclusive jurisdiction over increased to all of the former slaves that had not become state citizens. And there are many reasons why I do not like the 14th Amendment. The first is that it was never ratified. But don't let the facts get in the way of a good story, right, folks? State versus Phillips, quote, I cannot believe that any court in full possession of all its faculties would ever rule that the 14th Amendment was properly approved and adopted. This is a court case in the Utah Supreme Court. Further, in 1967, Congress tried to repeal the 14th Amendment on the ground that it was invalid, void, and unconstitutional. The Congressional Record for the House, June 13, 1967, page 15,641. The 9 pages of argument that are recorded here detail the infirmities that prove the 14th Amendment was never properly ratified and thus is not law. The 14th Amendment reads in a pertinent part, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. There's that word, reside, residence. The validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned, end quote. So when the IRS is knocking on your door, it's because you have residence in one of the union states as a United States citizen who is responsible for the debt. There's a wealth of deception in the wording that you just heard because of the sheer number of words that have specific or multiple meanings in law depending on how they're used. So if we go to the part that says, quote, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, the word the is used in the singular form, not plural, as in the word jurisdiction. If Congress meant the several states rather than the District of Columbia, it would have been more correct to say and subject to the jurisdictions, but it didn't. Jurisdiction was singular. In addition, a new pecking order is established with the phrase, quote, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, end quote. If you research the term resident and legal resident, you'll find that it is the nexus that binds us to all the states and federal enforcement of commercial statutes today. Resident is the short form of resident alien, and it is used in state statutes to mean someone who exhibits actual presence in an area belonging to one nation while retaining a domicile citizenship status within another foreign nation. So as a Floridian, I'm in Florida, but I will be assumed to be a resident of Florida domiciled out of Washington, D.C. The term legal resident further indicates that these two forms may be applied either to a geographical jurisdiction or a political jurisdiction. An individual may reside in one or the other, or in both at the same time. If in California, Government Code Section 126, it sets forth the essential elements of a compact between this state and the federal government, allowing reciprocal taxation of certain entities, and provide for concurrent jurisdiction within geographical boundaries. Both state citizens and federal citizens are Americans. U.S. citizens are domiciled in the District of Columbia and are privileged alien to the state wherein they reside. And state citizens are domiciled within their state, and they are not aliens in that state. They do not reside in that state. They are citizens of that state. The distinction may seem insignificant to you, but it is not to the court. A state citizen has the right to travel in each of the 50 states. He or she can file papers in any county courthouse and in any state and become a citizen of that state. Most of the federal statute laws do not apply to citizens of a state. If the authority of the statute can be found in the organic constitution, then the statute is of national character and it would apply to both citizens of either state or federal and aliens as well. Upon introducing the provisions which eventually became U.S. Code 18, Section 242. So everybody knows 18, 242. That's the criminal aspect of deprivation of rights under color of law. Its sponsor, Senator Stewart, explicitly stated that the bill protected all persons. That's a word. He noted that the bill, quote, simply extends to foreigners and not citizens the protection of our laws. United States versus Otherson, 480 F. Supp, 1369. This is a 1979 decision. That's what it said. So what could this mean? Well, it implies that the citizens of a state already had the protections introduced by the statute, but now it extends to foreigners, this protection. So what is a foreigner if they're not also an alien? This is why that when you hear me talk to people about, you know, assisting them in their pleadings, that anytime you have to quote a statute, you refer to it as their statute, not yours, not something you're bound to, because you're a union state citizen. Privileges granted by the sovereign governments in their capacity to license, meaning to condone what might otherwise be illegal, and always taxable and are regulatable. Rights such as those envisioned by our founding fathers are not taxable and they're not regulatable because they exercise common right that would be completely destroyed by government through taxation or regulation. These are maxims of the law, so they're so well established that they're irrefutable. Look at Frost and Frost Trucking versus Railroad Commission of California, 1925. Now, in 1868, we have a class of citizenship created. That's the 14th Amendment, which is, quote, subject, end quote, by grant of privilege from a sovereign power. Who is that sovereign power? It's the federal Congress. And they're exercising exclusive authority to govern its territories under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. Federal citizens are created by the Congress. It's not your birth certificate. You're a creation of the Congress with a Social Security number. Just like you'd inventory any property, a merchant would inventory their property with a SKU number and things like that. Same thing. It is self-evident that all state citizens are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that the governments are instituted to secure these rights. It's also self-evident that the truth is that the sovereign creator can never create an entity, a government, and assign it more power than what the creator possessed to begin with. Think about that. It's a self-evident truth. The creator can never create an entity and then assign it more power than the creator possessed to begin with. Think about that. Further, the Constitution of the United States of America did not repeal the Articles of Confederation. It was only intended, quote, to make a more perfect union, end quote. So what does that mean? That means it was amended. The Articles of Confederation were amended, renamed a constitution for the United States of America. Therefore, it logically follows that the creator did not purposely intend to alter their status as the master to accept a role as the servant of its own creation. This is plainly shown throughout the Constitution, but especially set forth in the 10th Amendment. United States versus Darby, 1941. Cooper versus Aaron, 1958. That's what they all talk about. The right to tax and regulate the national citizenship is an inherent right under the rule of the law of nations, which is part of the law of the United States, as described in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. So, you know, we can go on and on in this. I think that GW has been very, very patient, and I want to thank him for his patience. It's time for me to turn this call over to him. Brother, I apologize for taking so much of your time.
It's okay. You got a little extra time this Monday, and you had a lot to say.
Here's something else I want to say to everybody on the call. Write this down if you don't already know it. www.correctmystatus.com. Share that with your friends. It will redirect them to AmericanByBirth.com, and there you'll find across the header two banners running from right to left. The top banner will say, "Once we were colonists, subject to a king." download it, click on it, download it, print it, read it and reread it a dozen times, three times, four, 30, 40, 50 times, read it. Read it till you can start speaking the words before your eyes are laid upon the words. Because that is the key for you understanding and internalizing these differences that I just spoke about. The other one is really a college-level read. It's called The Greatest Story Never Told, and I encourage you to read that too, but only after you thoroughly have internalized once we were colonists subject to a king. Thank you for letting me get that little quib in there.
Sure. Sure. No, sounds good. This week has been, it's been interesting as usual. Just a lot of people coming and talking about their issues. And, I've been on with, it's just kind of interesting how all the, different groups out there are talking about state citizen, of course, right now, and it's becoming very, very popular to get this information and start to understand it. And of course, they're getting them off in all these different directions. I was on with a guy today that was referred to me, and he's trying to do these crazy 1099 OID processes. And after I gave him my testimony and told him what, you know, happened with me, he's like, I think I'm gonna just rescind those. It's like, yeah, probably a good idea. But anyway, I don't have anything extraordinary to share or any huge breaking news or anything like that. So this call is about the people that have come to it to understand how to correct their status and walk in that and understand how to use it. And so that's, we do it, of course, through the U.S. State Department, which is the number one entity in the land, so to speak, in Washington, D.C., that has jurisdiction and also has the authority to issue passports so that you may pass freely, and what is said about you on the back channel of information that they have, you know, as according to your case file, about who you are and how you state yourself to be. And so really that's the one place that you want to correct it. We do that through a pretty easy process that, like Michael was talking about a little earlier, how would that defendant prove he is not a U.S. citizen? Well, affidavit is a very powerful instrument that can be used in any administrative or judicial matter that you can put in until it's rebutted. It stands as evidence and stands as truth. And it's the highest, pretty much the highest form of evidence you can put into any kind of situation like that. So that's one of the things that we do. And we get a corrected passport, brand new corrected passport card. We teach people how to operate with in country, so to speak, in the 50 states, okay, of the what we call the United States of America. We teach them to use the card, probably instead of their license, which is a another type of instrument that is a little bit more. If we want to say, it puts you in a greater liability when you use your license instead of using your God-given rights to travel. And so we teach and try to educate people on how to interface with police officers and whatnot in that situation, and how to do it respectfully and in honor so that no situations escalate. And we've been very, very, very successful with that and have prevailed. So with that said, I'll just turn the call over to, I believe, Martin, if he's there.
Yeah.
And open it up for questions and answers now.
Thank you. Yes. Star 2, keypad, folks, if you have a question, star 2 at this time to raise your hand. If you're listening on the Freedoms Radio side, type your questions in the question bar at this time and click submit. First question comes from Brent in Arizona. Go ahead, Brent.
I didn't think I was that fast hitting star 2. good evening, folks. Two things. GW, I'd just like to add my testimony. I think you already got it, but a couple weeks ago, I was pulled over by a police officer for going almost 65 and a 45. And he insisted on getting my registration and stuff. And I kept telling him I don't own a driver's license. And I gave him my passport card, and he kept insisting that he get my driver's license. And we went back and forth for a while until he finally just accepted the passport card and went back to his cruiser. And he was one of the first things out of his mouth, you know, when I handed him the passport card was, "Are you one of those sovereign citizen people?" And, you know, he kind of said it with an attitude. But after about 20 minutes, he came back and handed me my stuff and said, with a smile on his face, totally different attitude, said, you know, "Slow down, have a nice day."
Wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
And the second thing I wanted to ask is, Michael, was your dialogue this evening reading from Once We Were Colonists?
No, actually, it was not. It was something else that I had. When I first, a year ago, when I was first introduced to GW here, I had done to come up to speed so I wouldn't sound like an idiot talking to him. I did a lot of research for a couple, 3 weeks, and I kept the research that I had I collected the research that I had found, and I put it into an organized fashion so that if when I'm doing a presentation, you know, an introduction or whatever, I can just jump in on some of these things.
Well, that's the clarity and the organization is just phenomenal, just fantastic. I'm going to go back and write all that stuff down. Like, do you want to forward a copy to me?
Yeah, I'll send you a copy. No big deal.
No, that'd be awesome. Really,
the whole thing here, listen, folks, the whole thing here is that we want to restore the recognition of our constitutional republic. If I were in a meeting, a town hall meeting or whatever, and so-and-so senator or congressman came to town, and he once opened his – if he once said or she once said – you know, something about democracy, I would stand up, bolt up, and call him a traitor. I says, what don't you understand about you're here to serve the Constitutional Republic? Leave Washington, D.C.'s democracy out of this. And let's get the debate started. You know, this thing, there's a change going on in our country, folks. There's a major shift of things happening right now. You've got between Target and Budweiser, they've lost over $20 billion.
$28 billion.
Now you want to put that in perspective. Our national debt in 1960 was $260 billion, and they just lost a tenth of that. They just lost 10% of that in the last month.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people are, as they learn, they're taking a stand. I'll be talking to the people at Target this week, the manager, Tatiana is her name. And I'm going to look her in the face and say, "Tatiana, you will never see me again in the store." And I said, "You have shown, your company has demonstrated it serves Satan. It's hired a Satanist to design jewelry for you." Every employee of Target who considers themselves a Christian, or a Jew for that matter, continue to work, they are denying their inheritance. whichever it is that they believe that they're entitled to. They're denying their Creator and siding with the enemy of the Creator. So they all should expect real bad karma coming soon to them. There's nobody here that works for you that should work for you if they are believers. I'm going to tell them that.
Good for you. Yeah. Thanks for piping in there, Brent. That's great.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Thank you, Brent.
Star 2 on your keypad, folks. If you have a question, star 2 on your keypad or type it in on the Freedom's Radio site.
Paul over on Freedom's Radio has something, Martin.
All right, GW, how does a man or a woman proceed if stopped by law enforcement once their status is corrected?
Great question. Actually, I'd rather have GW, I want to hear your input, but let's go back to
Brent.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could. I think that would be good. I think we could just let Brent give a step-by-step little demonstration of how he handled it, and that way it's coming firsthand from somebody that's correct their status, that's not the supposed guru, and it would be good. Brent, do you want to chime in? And
I'll be happy to.
Okay.
Yeah, so first of all, I am not very good verbally, especially when put on the spot. Words don't come very easily to me, and I'm not a quick thinker. And my memory is not all that great, so remembering all these laws and codes and things like that and trying to present a case to the officer is not something that I would do very well. Obviously, I wouldn't have been going nearly 20 miles over the speed limit if I wasn't in a hurry. So when the cop came, turned on his light, I thought, oh, great, I got to deal with this. Well, at least I had my get-out-of-jail-free card. So, I pulled off, and I was very calm because of that. I wasn't too nervous. But when he really pressured me about the driver's license thing, initially I tried to just hand him the passport card respectfully and said, I suggested that he use that to check my identification and credentials. But again, the verbiage that I used probably was not sufficient or adequate for the situation. And he wanted my registration and proof of insurance and all that stuff, which I had, and I handed it to him. And then the issue was the driver's license, and he did not want to take the passport card as my means of travel. And like I said, we just went back and forth about that quite a bit, and I kept telling them I don't own a driver's license. I don't have one. And he said, he kept asking me questions like, have you ever had one in your life? And when was the last time you had one? And, all this kind of stuff. And I tried to avoid those questions, but when I did, it tended to escalate the situation. So,
let me interject right here real quick. A law professor, and this was on YouTube. This is where I learned it, on YouTube. This law professor, big mucky muck, said if a policeman ever asks you questions, just say, I'm not answering questions. I'm not answering that question, that particular question. Thank you. And you have every right to. And say to them, look, if you're going to pursue this, maybe I need to have my attorney here.
Okay.
Well, I'm not answering your questions. I've given you what is required. The State Department of the United States issued me this identification, and I'm to present this for every travel issue there is, whether it's on an airplane or whatever. This is my identification. If you won't accept it, then you may want to continue as though I have no identification and if you arrest me or ticket me or whatever, whatever, that's on you. But this is what the State Department of the United States, which I think holds a bigger badge number than you do.
Okay. So eventually he accepted the passport card. He went back to his cruiser, and you guys know the rest of the story. But yeah, I would have handled it a little differently had I been more prepared, or if it happens again next time.
I think you did a great job.
I do too.
Great experience.
And yeah, what a great feeling to be in that situation and have the officer come back. Oh, and so the officer did come back, and he had this, I think for his own purposes, he issued me a warning on paper, and he put fake information on the warning. It wasn't even my real information.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So.
Fake information. Even though he had your real information.
He had my real information. He put fake information on the warning. It was just totally for
him. Weird. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So that should suffice for the person that asked that question.
Well, how about Martin? You guys, GW, why don't you go over what you would do? We heard from Michael, as far as you don't have to answer any questions.
So basically, having the card, I would first off, when they ask for a driver's license, I wouldn't have any qualms telling them that, the definition of a license is permission to do what is otherwise illegal or immoral. And as a born-again believer of my Lord Jesus Christ and a follower of the Word, I don't want to do anything that's immoral. And, of course, I don't want to have permission to do what is illegal. So I don't drive. I decided I don't drive because that's a commercially regulated activity. It requires a license. I travel, which is my God-given right. And so I have a traveler's card right here, sir. So, I don't know how they would deal with that, but that's kind of, that's basically what I would do. And then I would just stand my ground and let it escalate to wherever they needed their supervisor to come in or whatever. Because in a lot of different cases, it might escalate to that point where their supervisor comes. And always, when they come, they always are like, okay, we need to, we need to run this card. They run the card, they come back to the car, and they do something very similar every time. They have a different attitude, and they just tell you, hey, listen, please travel safely, and, maybe slow it down a little. And that's it.
One of the things that's very, very important, remember the phrase, quote, loss prevention officer.
Mm-hmm.
Loss prevention officer. So if it starts escalating, say, before you proceed, and I'm just trying to help you out here, buddy. I'm just trying to help you. You may want to consider contacting your shift commander, and you may want to contact your loss prevention officer, because you are, I suspect, getting ready to cross that line into something that in lawyer talk is deprivation of rights under color of law. And that can be very, very, very expensive, not only for you personally, but for your employer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say it with a straight face? With love in your heart. I'm only trying to help you, buddy.
Yeah.
So I hope that answered Paul's question. Martin, anybody else?
Star 2 on your keypad. Folks, if you have a question, star 2. Bruce in Texas, go ahead.
How are you doing tonight? We talked a little bit about this, I think it was last week, about I'm about to apply to start taking Social Security. I have not changed my status yet. And I forget, I apologize, one of you had mentioned you might want to call us and discuss that. So in general terms, what is the advice to start that process either before or after changing status?
Okay. So I think, Michael, last time we had this question, you suggested to be on the Tuesday night call.
Well, I was going to ask if this is a better call for tomorrow, a better question for tomorrow night rather than tonight.
I think Michael suggested that it would probably be a better question for Brother
Tuesday.
John.
Okay.
Yeah, with Social Security, the whole Social Security thing, I think we can give you a clearer answer there.
Okay.
But the key is this, is that correcting your status in no way deprives you of any of your your veteran monies, Social Security, any money that's due you.
Okay.
You paid into that. That's a contract. It's not an entitlement. You even have a congressman now saying, well, we need to cut back entitlements and, you know, Social Security. Mm-hmm.
It's a contract. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, even DeSantis talked about that, trying to cut Social Security, and boy, he got a lot of pushback. And Trump is making a lot of fun of, you know, that's just one thing that you'd never want to do. Talking about cutting people's Social Security off.
Yeah, I don't know how many people are on Social Security in the nation, but it's tens of millions, certainly, and you want to alienate tens of millions of voters in one second, that's the way to do it.
Especially when we hear all the billions of dollars spent on illegal aliens.
Yeah.
That burns me up. Let's not go there right now. But it was interesting the last few days, if you listen to the conservative talk radio, about how they're talking about how good it is that there's a large pool of Republican contenders, because that means Trump takes all the oxygen in the room and the other guys each get 3 or 4%. So, you know, that's good. And if he actually does get charged or convicted of something that he might have to go to jail for, then, okay, DeSantis is generally a good guy, and there's other good guys there. But, you know, it gives us options with some people that are genuinely conservative. They may not have all the best ideas, and DeSantis is relatively a young guy, so doesn't have all the experience yet. I say let him stay governor of Florida. They love him there. So, but... you know, but everybody else is going for VP, I think. That's just my opinion, but that's not what this is about. So I'll move on and wait till tomorrow for the Social Security question.
All right. Next, Mark.
Thank you. And then we've got Brian back in Texas. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, Michael Martin. And GW, just a quick comment on the target thing and situations like that. You might already know it, but that goes back to ESG investing with BlackRock. And many, supposedly many states are trying to bash that, and it goes with, a Biden rule or law he's putting in, too, so. I'm not sure how effective your strategy is going to be at the target manager, but they'll probably just replace her and put somebody else in. But maybe worth it.
It'll make Michael feel good.
That's what's important. I just wanted to make that comment. I'm sure you already knew it, but that's all I have.
All right. Martin, I thought I saw Kent raise his hand a little bit ago. Did he change his mind, or Was I mistaken?
Am I still on?
Yeah.
I raised my hand earlier, and somehow I got knocked off of the hand raise, and I did it again. I raised my hand instead of putting my hand down, so something might have happened with the system.
Something may have. So, Kent, you're unmuted. What's up?
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Of course.
So, one question. What would prevent someone from being a, when we talk about being a citizen of one of the several states, what would prevent one from being a citizen of more than one of the several states?
Well, I mean, it's I don't know if it would be necessary, okay, to be a citizen of more than one. I mean, what are you trying to accomplish? What's the need here?
Well, I don't know if it would be necessary either. I was just thinking about it while it was being talked about as to why it would be restricted to one. I mean, we have people, for example, you know, on the East Coast that spend half of their time in New York or, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, whatever, and half of their time in Florida. And, you know, they're always concerned about, oh, I want to be a Florida resident because I have homestead rights.
On this call, there's some really good stuff being covered.
I'm sorry?
And that was somebody that didn't mute out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think the full faith and credit clause makes it unnecessary.
Okay.
I mean, if I were a businessman, I would be certainly wanting to show that I, you know, was domiciled in a state that did not have a state income tax. Even though correcting my status, I'm not liable to it to begin with. It doesn't matter. I still want to, you know, make it easy on myself to fight the harder battle later. Fight the harder battle later.
Right. Do you have any other comment, Gregor?
No. I mean, no, because I mean, if you give me an actual situation for, you know, that's a necessity of why you would be wanting that, it'd be easier for me to kind of go about, you know, trying to figure out a remedy here. But it's just kind of a
So let me enhance it a little bit. So let's say you spent your time or divided your time up between a couple different states or three or four different states. It might be more advantageous when you were spending your time in that other state be considered a citizen in the from a de jure point of view of that state than it would be to say, well, even under the full faith and credit clause, you know, I'm a citizen of another state. Goes back to what Mike just said about, you know, even though with your status corrected as an American national, you wouldn't be subject to the state income tax, you could still want to make it easy on yourself and say, well, let me be in a state where there is no state income tax. And then I just don't have to deal with the issue at all. So I'm looking at that from the same perspective of spending time in multiple different locations.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, you could work those things out with having a home that you have documentation on that you need to show somebody. My whole thing is, you know, once I, a long, long time ago, okay, unwound the net and the tentacles of the taxing authorities from me and my name, I don't care where I go, where I stay. But I know there's people that need to file certain things for, you know, to get certain benefits. This is where everybody always gets in trouble. It's like, you know, when you're filling out forms and you need to prove up certain things because they're asking you for certain verifications and they only accept certain verified proof. Okay, that's when it gets a little more sticky. For me, I just, you know, it's been a full on disengage and have nothing to do with them anymore. So, If you have a certain situation, it's easier to kind of go and target it.
Well, I think, you know, I am dealing with a situation where somebody's demanding some kind of verified proof. And basically what I'm asking them is I'm demanding that they produce the law that says that they have the right to even ask for this proof, and that that law would even apply to me, and that I would have to prove that up. And so far I've been through three people, and none of them seem to be able to meet that standard. And I pointed out to them that I thought it was a rather elementary and basic standard that I was asking them to comply with. So we'll see where it goes. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll continue to deal with it.
But, okay.
You know, that doesn't directly go to the issue of being a it could go to the issue of being a citizen in more than one state. On the issue that you're talking about where they want proof and they want you to fill out a form, just as a matter of information, I found it convenient sometimes to leave certain information off of the form, give it back to them, and then have no pen available, and do this when people are in a rush. And you'll find that they write information in, and I can't be responsible for what somebody else wrote in on a form, and it's clearly not in my handwriting. So, you know, I don't know. I guess they can write in anything they want.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring to your attention, in case you didn't see it, you're familiar with who Todd Callender is?
Todd Callender. The name's familiar.
He's an attorney.
Oh, yes, he's an attorney. Yes,
right.
Yes.
Done work with the vax issue and other issues. Mm-hmm. He pointed out in a video this week that he now believes that there's some 25 million people who have revoked their consent to be collateral property, and I guess that goes over to becoming an American national or claiming the status of American national, et cetera. But they've revoked the collateral property issue and being a shadow for the debt. Incurred by the government, mm-hmm. or incurred by the birth certificate. So I had no idea that this could be 25 million people. I thought that was pretty interesting. And I don't think he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that would just shoot a number out there for the heck of shooting some number out there. So.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, you might want to go and look at that video. It was on Rumor Mill News. Probably about 3-4 days ago. And the last thing I wanted to say is I was last week I was at a mayor council meeting over another issue. I'd never been to that meeting before, but because of a certain issue that I may have to deal with, I decided to go to the meeting to see how they're operating, et cetera. So I chose not to speak in the public session, but I went up afterwards and spoke to the mayor. It's kind of a small town, but they do have a council and a mayor. And in a subsequent conversation with the mayor, which lasted somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour, I think we were the last one to vacate the building that evening, short of the police department still being there. He was saying to me, he says, there's a lot of information out there. He said, you could put our municipal court to rest and that there's a process that you could use that we wouldn't be able to go anywhere on these kind of issues. Then he started talking about some other things. And so, you know, I picked up on the conversation, fed into the conversation what I thought was necessary. And it was a friendly conversation. And I think that he's going to be somebody worth going back to and talking to again. So there are people out there that are, you know, filling the roles of mayors and council members, et cetera, that know that there's something up in this country and that everything is not necessarily copacetic. And while they may be putting on a show up in front of the room there, you know, they know that the story is something other than what they're presenting and what the other people may be presenting there. So I also spoke to them about mm-hmm. the fact that they had a military flag there and they were pledging allegiance to the military flag and why I wouldn't do so. So anyway, I think I just point that out as a piece of interesting information. There's always things, like Mike says, there's always things you can do, always people you can talk to if you just look for the right opportunities.
It's true. Very, very true.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, thank you so much. Ron in Florida, did you have something to add?
Yes, in reference to Kent's question on state citizenship. you were looking for a specific situation. How about purchasing guns? Most of them want you to be a resident or a state citizen in order to purchase guns in that state. And if you want to purchase something like myself in Florida, I'm in Texas, and I want to purchase a gun, or in Kentucky or someplace else. Kentucky is a very gun-friendly state. Opinion?
I have no experience yet with anybody purchasing a, you know, firearm, whatnot, from another state, being successful, doing it from another state where your passport and passport card don't align you with the state that you're in that you're trying to buy the firearm from. Only very successful with, you know, purchasing firearms in the state in which you've been issued the actual passport card. So it's kind of, it's one of those things where, I'm not sure how somebody would go about that or what the procedure would be, because they just, you know, they just turn you down right off the bat if you don't, if you can't show evidence of, you know, living in the state. So I don't know how you do that.
Well, living in Florida, if I could choose to move to Texas and purchase, you know, a weapon there, my passport card would show Florida residency rather than, or occupancy rather than residency, that I'm a member of Florida rather than Texas on my passport card.
Yeah. Yep.
Something
like
to be
sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Yield.
Okay. Okay, Martin. Might be a long bathroom break there.
Might be. All right, that's the call for this evening. Let me check Freedom's Radio real quick to see if there's any other questions over here. Paul wrote back, when traveling outside the 50 states and territories besides passport card, what are the documents need to be carried? Well, it would be your passport.
Yeah, you got that one. In this process.
All right. Thank you, Brad, for your patience. Michael Edward here. How are you doing tonight?
Hey. I didn't know this was live, so I was kind of half expecting
it. No, it's not. It was recorded. I sent you a text.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was cooking lunches for this week. Yeah, so let me turn this off. I don't know. A few weeks ago, I let you guys know. I was back in November, actually. That I had gotten stopped, and I had my Vietnamese wife with me, who speaks very little English and had never driven on an interstate. We were 50 miles away from home, and I got stopped. And I just decided to go ahead and give the driver's license, and if I got a ticket, I thought there was something I could do about it. But anyway, what I did just got thrown in the trash, and so they eventually rescinded my driver's license. Or cancel it. So I thought that was that, but when we tried to get our registration renewed, they said the account had been locked, and that's anybody that has any relation to me. So that would have been my wife's car, my parents' cars. So ultimately, I had to go ahead and pay that ticket. And my first question is, does that somehow nullify or do damage to what I did when I got the passport and with the affidavit and everything? My second question is, they have not, so I did that on Thursday, And supposedly on Friday, it should have been in the system, and my dad could go ahead and pick up his registration. But as of today, they said, no, that it's not showing that it's been paid. So I'm just wondering, is there some little legal trick they're pulling here or something that I could kind of expect?
Well, you heard about the efficiency of the post office, right, and all the compassion of the IRS?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, you have your proof of payment, right?
Yes, I can provide that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would provide that to them, and ask them to go look for that money. This is one of the things I would do. If that's number one. Going back to the traffic case, I was told, and again, remember now, I'm not an information provider. John is, GW, and so forth. They're information providers. I would ask John, is it true that you can open up, reopen a case that's closed and go back to it, even after the appellate review is lapsed? And I believe the answer is yes. So that's something that you may want to pursue just for the sake of you know, having the correct score on the bulletin board, if you would. You've read Once We Were Calling a Subject to a King, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So do you remember that part in there? Let me pull it up here real quick so that I quote it correctly. Don't want to give out wrong information. There you are. All the way up here. There we go. The acceptance, this is WW Cargill Company versus State of Minnesota, 180 U.S. 452. This was adjudicated in 1901, and it's never been overturned. Quote, the acceptance of a license, in whatever form, will not impose upon the licensee an obligation to respect or to comply with any provision of the statute or with the regulations prescribed that are repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, end quote.
Right.
Okay. So you're familiar with that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, right there, that question was never addressed in your court case because you never attended the court. There was no court case for you to attend. It was all administratively executed upon you, correct?
Right.
Okay. So I'd ask about how long ago was that time-wise? How many months, years, whatever?
Yeah, the ticket was November 15th, I believe.
All right, so we're less than 6 months old. I would think that deprivation of rights under color of law for the law enforcement officer, for the prosecutor, for the judge, whoever has their signature on whatever it is that you did, would be something to look forward to. And that's one thing that I would bring up to John.
Yeah, okay. So next time we talk, I haven't, my records are 30 miles away. I haven't been able to get down there yet. But so I know, you know, we had that call and gave me some homework. But I haven't been able to get down there quite yet. So.
All right.
But as soon as my dad is able to get that registered, I guess I'll call the county clerk to find out what's going on. I'm just wondering, are they going to say, well, because of what I did, because I David straighted it, and I know you guys are really proud of me for that, but I wrote, you know, on a red Sharpie across the page, basically this is, you know, deprivation of rights and the color of law and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm just wondering if they're trying to stick it to me for being an idiot.
You're not being an idiot. You've seen the letter from the government travel. It's from the travel division. Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Yeah, you sent me those. I have those.
Okay.
And, yeah,
so,
I get it.
You know, the question
begs. I'm an idiot because they just ignore it.
Okay. Well, anyone that ignores it you're wanting to get their full name and where, you know, what address that they would receive a summons to. And work is fine. You don't have to get ask them their home address. Just work is fine. And that they all become part of a trail of people to include in that that federal lawsuit.
Wouldn't that be the judge?
Including the judge. Yeah.
Because
so you,
they told
whoever signature is on the order.
I called them within the 30-day period. I called them and asked, you know, to know where the case was. And I said, well, some paperwork was received, which would have been my letter. And what I didn't do, it's so stupid. I don't know why I didn't do it, but I didn't send it certified. So there's no proof that they ever got it. And I thought, probably he just watered it up and threw it away. And that was the idiotic thing, but. They did tell me.
Now you can circumvent that a little bit. You can circumvent that a little bit by an affidavit stating that you placed a letter to this address by first class mail, and so forth. And that it, there's a law out there somewhere that says that any time that you put something in the mail, first class mail, it is deemed to be accepted by the date of the canceled stamp.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to do that. I'm $300 down now.
Understood.
But when I get my homework assignment finished, I will send it to you, and then on our next call with Brother John, we'll bring that up and see if we can play with that.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thank you for answering the call.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Anyways, is that it?
Yeah, that's it for now.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. We're going to return tomorrow night with another recorded call because Brother John is going into the hospital again tomorrow for more back surgery. It's the never-ending story, and he's usually off deck for a day or two after that. So we'll be running a recording, and like it is tonight where I audit the calls. Likewise, I'll do so tomorrow night as well. Now, the reason that you want to be on tomorrow night's call is because typically with Brother John, you're going to hear a direct application of your corrected political citizenship status being employed within the court system. So that's what we're going to be probably talking about tomorrow night. I say probably because it is a recorded call, and I'm not sure which one exactly is going to be presented tomorrow night. So until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.